Welcome to our podcast series, Elected Ed, in which we talk about issues affecting the everyday governing environment for local elected officials throughout North Carolina. We're coming to you from our studio here at the UNC School of Government in Chapel Hill. I'm Patrice Rossler, Manager of Elected Official Programming here with the school's Center for Public Leadership and Governance. Today we're talking about health care for minors. The North Carolina General Assembly recently enacted what's called the Parents' Bill of Rights. Our guest is Kirsten Liloudis, Assistant Professor of Public Law and Government here at the UNC School of Government. Her field of expertise is public health law. Kirsten, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here, Patrice.
This bill, as I understand it, Kirsten, establishes a number of rights for parents, and there are three parts to the bill. Could you describe for us in short form the three major portions of the bill?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the full name of the legislation is actually an act to enumerate the rights of parents to direct the upbringing, education, healthcare, and mental health of their minor children. It's a long name.
Wow.
Colloquially, a lot of folks are referring to it by its session law name, which is Session Law 2023-106, or sometimes as SB 49, so Senate Bill 49. But I think the most common way folks are referring to it really is the Parents' Bill of Rights. And that's in part because this first section of the law is titled the Parents' Bill of Rights. So part one of the bill enumerates 10 rights for parents in North Carolina. And some of these are really reiterations of existing state or federal laws. So, for example, the state law says that a parent has the right to access their child's education records to the extent permitted by the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, or FERPA. That right already existed in federal law, and it's being reiterated here in the Parents' Bill of Rights. But there are a few new things. So, for example, Part 1 says that parents have a right to prohibit the creation, sharing, or storage of their child's biometric scan without parental consent.
Tell us what a biometric scan is.
Well, that's a great question, Patrice, and the answer is we don't know. Biometric scan is actually not defined in the law, and so it's not quite clear what that's going to encompass. Does it mean your child's thumbprint when they log into their iPhone or an image of their face? We're not yet really sure what that's going to cover.
Is somebody working on that definition?
That's a great question, too. I don't know if there's a definition coming to us in legislation, but I know there are lots of school attorneys across the state who are helping their clients, local school boards, public school units, try and interpret what a biometric scan might be so that they can comply with this part of the law. So part two of the Parents' Bill of Rights is really focused on parents' rights in the public education setting. And there are a lot of new requirements that apply to schools, including requirements to provide certain notices to parents at the start of every school year, requirements to create processes for parents to review and provide input on school curriculum, and also requirements for schools to submit reports to the State Board of Education to demonstrate that they are, in fact, complying with this new law. And then there's part three. And part three is really my bread and butter. It's what I've been focusing on for the last couple of months, in part because it's created a lot of questions for local health departments. And those are the folks that I work with most directly.
So this is the part that really affects our governing environment at the local government level, right?
Yes, especially when it comes to the provision of health care. And sometimes folks think local government isn't involved in health care.
Ooh.
But actually, it is, exactly. Right. We have 86 local health departments in North Carolina serving all 100 counties, and almost every single one of them provides clinical care of some type, and that could be things like free childhood immunizations or cancer screenings. It could be things like diabetes management. And so there's actually a lot of healthcare being provided by local governments at the local level. There also is healthcare being provided by school nurses or in local jails. So this bill does have an impact on local governments, especially part three.
It recalls for me, Kirsten, experience in my childhood, which had to do with tuberculosis. We had tuberculosis in our family, and our public health department is where my mom took us every month to have x-rays, chest x-rays, and skin tests for 2 years.
Yeah, local public health is really on the front lines, especially of communicable disease work in our communities. And they're here to serve everyone. But when we talk about the clinical healthcare services they provide, we're oftentimes talking about folks who may not have access to a major hospital system, folks who may be uninsured or underinsured. So they provide really important services to folks in our communities and kind of help keep us all safe that way.
If you think about the health care for minors, what age is considered minor in North Carolina?
That's a great question. So a minor in North Carolina, and this is actually defined in this new law, the Parents' Bill of Rights, is a person who's under age 18 who hasn't been emancipated or married. And we have to pause for a second and talk about both of those terms, married and emancipated. So in North Carolina, up until a couple of years ago, you could become married at age 14 or 15. But a few years ago, we had a new law passed that said, actually, you have to be 16 or 17 years old to get married. We have a similar requirement for emancipation. Emancipation is a process where a minor goes in front of a court and says, let me demonstrate to you all the ways in which I am mature, just like an adult. You should treat me like an adult for the purpose of contracting and work and all these other things. And so if you're 16 or 17, you can go before a court, and if you present a compelling enough argument, the court can say, all right, we're going to emancipate you. Emancipation is not very common, and neither is marriage of 16 or 17-year-olds in North Carolina, and in both instances, you'd expect the minor to have some type of documentation showing that they are either married, so a marriage certificate, or that they're emancipated, which would look like a court order. So a minor is anyone, again, who's under 18, who's not married or emancipated.
Did this law change something in those definitions?
This law did not change the definition of a minor in North Carolina. The definition that we have in Part 3 of the law aligns with the definition of minor that we see in other existing statutes.
I'm struck by how this legislation could affect our local government workforce, especially those who work in the healthcare professions, Kirsten. I think especially about the public health nurses, but I also wonder about EMS workers or DSS employees who, especially if they represent a child as their guardian. What does this law mean for those kinds of people who either have to do health care in an emergency situation or who are responsible for a care of somebody as if they were a parent?
One question that I've gotten a lot since this law went into effect is what's really changed? And at first blush, when I was reviewing the legislation, I thought, oh, this changes everything. In fact, that's actually really not the case. This law codifies a requirement to obtain parental consent before providing treatment to a minor. That's what you see in Part 3 of the Parents' Bill of Rights. And it really just codifies that requirement. We had that requirement previously because you could read it into other existing North Carolina laws.
Okay.
So, for example, you mentioned emergency care. We have an older set of statutes. It's that General Statute Chapter 90-21.1. And that describes situations in which a physician is allowed to move forward with providing care in emergency or urgent situations without getting parental consent. And really what that law is contemplating is that sometimes you might need to give a child care to save their life or prevent really serious harm or injury, and there's just not time to figure out who their parent is and get that consent. So because we have situations identified in law that said, here's when you don't have to get parental consent, what you could read into those is, except when these situations apply, you do need parental consent. So that requirement really existed previously, but now with Parents' Bill of Rights, it's codified, right? It's put into black and white. We have clearly defined terms and bright line definitions to use.
So going back to Part 1, it sort of is a mirror of how they handled the codification of those rights in Part 1 of the bill.
Yeah, that's right. So it's really a codification of an existing requirement.
Of existing requirements.
I think one thing that can be challenging is that when you have a requirement that has previously been kind of read into the law, kind of understood just by looking at things that outline exceptions, and then you turn that requirement into black and white text, right? You have defined terms. Sometimes it can feel like the boundaries or parameters have shifted a little bit. And so it takes folks a minute to understand the law as it's been codified and kind of figure out how to navigate those now really clearly, strictly defined requirements.
Are there any particular parts of this Part 3 of the bill that you think our local elected officials should pay particular attention to? Anything that's going to come up from their constituents or in their communities in terms of conversation about this?
Yeah, I think folks who are providing healthcare services or who are involved in healthcare services in any way at a local level may need some help figuring out who's allowed to consent to healthcare for minor patients and when. And part of that is because Part 3 creates this new requirement around parental consent. And so some folks have asked, for example, does this mean that minors can no longer consent to certain services under the Minors Consent Law in North Carolina? And spoiler alert, the answer is no, they can definitely still consent on their own. Okay. But that's a lot to navigate, right? And so I think folks should anticipate there are going to be questions about that, maybe some hesitancy, some uncertainty. But we have a really great resource here at the School of Government. It's something I have dubbed the Rainbow Chart because it is rainbow in color coordination. And it outlines different situations when you're treating a minor patient. So who can give consent? Is it the parent? Is it the DSS director? Is parental consent not required because you're in emergency situations and you need to just focus on saving this child's life?
That reminds me of school health nurses. If I think about the situations in which a child might need medical care or some sort of attention that's not anticipated, I think of school nurses. So what effect does this legislation have on those situations that might come up on a soccer field or a football field or somebody has an asthma attack in the middle of the day? What do you see as implications for school health environment, Kirsten?
I think there are at least two major implications that we can talk about. One that comes to us from Part 3 of the Parents' Bill of Rights and one that comes to us from Part 2. And I'll start with Part 3. So this new requirement, newly codified requirement to obtain parental consent prior to treating a minor, when that went into effect, there were questions about whether or not that trumped some existing language in our public education laws. So General Statute Chapter 115C is where you find our local public education laws in North Carolina. And we have a statute that says that in certain situations, school personnel are allowed to provide first aid and emergency care or other life-saving techniques to students. And that includes school nurses, but also teachers or substitute teachers. And it wasn't totally clear if this new requirement in Part 3 meant that folks now had to pause and get parental consent before they provided that care.
That would be frightening.
That could be potentially frightening, right? And really challenging for somebody who also, perhaps the school nurse, has an ethical duty to act and provide care consistent with the standard of care. So the General Assembly, I think, heard that feedback, and in the budget bill, which came out later in 2023, actually created some new language in Chapter 115C that makes really clear that school personnel are not bound by Part 3 of the Parents' Bill of Rights when it comes to that first aid or emergency care.
So a technical correction.
Exactly, yes.
Good.
So if you have that child, little Jimmy has no known history of allergies, but some sweet kid shares their cashew butter sandwich at lunch, and it turns out Jimmy does have a cashew allergy. He goes into anaphylaxis. If you need to administer that EpiPen, you don't have to wait to get parental consent, right? You want to go ahead and help that child out, save that child's life potentially, and provide that care.
So that seems to me like a fundamental, very basic thing that elected officials would like to know in case a parent were to say to them, have you heard what this bill does? Then at least they have that basic understanding that no, it does not prohibit children at school from getting emergency care if they need it. I think that could be just sort of basic information for them to take away.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing for local elected officials to be able to help educate their communities on, especially because there was some confusion when this law first went into effect.
That makes me wonder, Kirsten, are the local public health directors doing any kind of local government training on this bill? Is it too early for that?
So the local health directors, I think, are really focused on getting training for their staff. As we talked about earlier, a lot of them have clinical staff who provide health services, and a lot of our local health departments actually provide school nurses. under a contract.
Yeah.
And so they're definitely focused on making sure that their staff understand how to comply with the law, and also to make sure that their partners in local government also understand what the law says, so that everyone's on the same page and you can implement this law in a really fluid manner. So they've been providing trainings to their staff, and some of those trainings have actually come from the School of Government. So I've been doing some of those trainings out on the road, talking about the Parents' Bill of Rights with folks.
Nice. Is there anything about this legislation that we haven't touched on that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
So one other thing that I think folks might ask their local elected officials about comes out of Part 2 of the session law. And as we've discussed, Part 2 is really focused on parents' rights in the educational setting, in the public school educational setting. And there are new requirements around giving parents notifications at the start of the school year about various things. But one of those is a requirement that local public schools provide notice to parents about the means to consent to certain types of well-being questionnaires and health screening surveys.
What does that mean?
I don't know what your experience was in North Carolina, but growing up when I was a kid, sometimes folks would come into the school and they might administer a vision screening.
Yes.
To every single
dental
child.
Dental screenings. We had that.
Yes. I actually got one in preschool, and it helped identify strabismus my eye. And fortunately, I was able to get a referral and get corrective surgery, which kept me from going blind. So
amazing.
Wonderful. But these screenings are offered at various age levels throughout preschool and school. And so we're thinking vision, dental, hearing screening, sometimes other types of screenings. And one question that's been raised by Part 2 of this law is, when we talk about the means to consent, does that mean opt-in or opt-out? For a long time in North Carolina, local schools have been using an opt-out approach. And what that means is that every child in a certain grade might get that screening, that vision or dental or hearing screening, unless their parent reaches out to the school and says, I would not like my child to participate, right? They opt out. The question now is, does every single school need to transition over to an opt-in model? And of course, the concern is that parents get so much paperwork at the start of the year. There's a lot to keep up with. What's going to happen if now all these kids who would have been getting these screenings have to opt in, and maybe not everyone's returning that paperwork, or paperwork gets lost in a backpack? You know, are kids going to be missing some of these helpful screenings at really important developmental stages?
Interesting. So that kind of process, I'm thinking manual. You give them a piece of paper, take it home, get mom or dad to sign this. Seems like high risk in terms of return rate, yet I don't know how else you could do that except pen and paper.
So in North Carolina, when it comes to written consents for health services, it's generally permissible to use electronic consent forms.
Okay.
And so one thing that a lot of schools have been doing is turning to electronic consents, not just for this, but for other things that parents need to sign at the start of the school year. And I think that's in part just a reflection of how we use technology these days, too.
It's a different world. Right.
And when it comes to opt-in versus opt-out, you know, when I see the phrase means to consent in this new law, what that means to me is the means to consent. I think that could encompass an opt-in or an opt-out process. And so I think schools are going to have to talk to their attorneys, look at what their neighbors are doing, and figure out what's working best for them. But I think that this new law does not prohibit continued use of that opt-out process that schools have been using in the past.
And I would think also means could be interpreted as hard paper or electronic.
Yeah, I think you could interpret the law that way too.
Right. Our guest today has been Kirsten Lelutis, public health law expert here at the UNC School of Government. Kirsten, thank you for joining me in this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me, Patrice. It's always a pleasure.
I want to give special thanks to our incredible studio producer, Paul Bonner. If you like this podcast, you can like and subscribe to it on our website. We are also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. If you have ideas for additional topics, you can reach me at prosler@sog.unc.edu. That's prosler@sog.unc.edu. Thank you.
Thank you.